Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. For 50 years, the people of Burma lived under the strict control of a military dictatorship. For the past 3 years, the country, officially known as Myanmar, has slowly emerged from this near lifetime of isolation and repression. The military released the most prominent opposition leader from house arrest, and they allowed her to be elected to parliament. The president, a former military leader, released several hundred prisoners. And 1 year ago, the government ended formal media censorship. In return, Western countries, including the United States, lifted sanctions against the Asian country. But now, the democratic transition is being severely tested by ethnic violence and humanitarian crises, along with the kinds of corruption that follows large investments from foreign countries. And reporting on politics or sensitive subjects like ethnic unrest are still subject to censorship. Gabrielle Paluk has been living and working as a freelance journalist in Thailand and Burma since 2009. She has worked for VOA, Al Jazeera, Newsweek, the Christian Science Monitor, and The Diplomat. She also worked for the government-censored newspaper, the Myanmar Times, before the end of state censorship. Gabrielle, welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi, thanks.
Now, before we get into some of the specific issues, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about what it's like to live in Burma.
Living in Burma as a foreigner has changed a lot over the past 4 years. Mm-hmm. And it's become a lot more open, and a lot of the signs of development are becoming a lot more visible. There's more cars on the streets that are new, and you're starting to see foreign chains with franchises in the country. You're seeing a lot more tourists, and people have become a lot more open and more willing to talk about their belief, their political beliefs, mm-hmm. or their beliefs in general. And as a journalist, it's become a lot easier in the past year to work. You can openly go to press events. You can call people up and ask them questions and openly say that you're a journalist.
Okay. And the country itself, I know it a little bit from movies, and it seems to be like a poor version of Thailand. It's a big country, about almost the size of Texas, with 47 million people. Give us an idea about the geography of Burma.
Well, it's likely that there's actually closer to 60 million people living in the country. So they haven't done a census since the 80s, and they're okay. going to do their first census. So we All really right. have no idea how many people are there. But it's got a mountainous north, and on the south there's a beautiful archipelago of tropical islands. Mm-hmm. And then Rangoon, the economic capital, is basically in a swamp.
Right.
And the Irrawaddy River, which runs sort of dead through the center and then joins the Bay of Bengal a couple hours south of Yangon. There's the Irrawaddy River Delta, where a lot of the rice is produced. And on the west, on the western border with Thailand, again, it's, the beautiful mountains, and a lot of produce is grown there, or things in general are grown there, including opium. And it's mostly farmers and...
Mm-hmm. I know that the travel writers have definitely discovered Burma in the past year or two. I've seen a lot of stories about the beautiful beaches that parallel Thailand.
Yeah, and probably surpass Thailand's beaches.
Why is that? Because they're less crowded and...
Exactly. I haven't visited them much, to be honest.
Yeah.
But especially in the Morgue Archipelago, as you go quite far south onto the peninsular bit of in the Tanintari region. You know, it's like the Andaman Islands, mm-hmm. or the islands in the Andaman Sea in Thailand, except there's no tourists, okay. and there's no development. So, right. and there's way more of them.
Okay, and let's talk about some of the stories you've been working on in the past year. Let's start with the story you did about the censor, the official censor, and him losing his job.
Right. Well, when they ended pre-censorship, Thin Swe, who was the last chief censor of Myanmar, had to stop doing his job. He essentially he got moved to a different department, so it wasn't like he was mm-hmm. unemployed. But all the people who, for so many years, worked as censors and worked in what was the former Japanese secret police building, but was, you know, then became the censorship office, suddenly weren't going to be able to do that anymore because there was no more pre-censorship. Mm-hmm. Their office has turned into a type of registry, so people still have to bring books and stuff to them. Yes. But Thin Swe wrote a very, you know, touching essay about what it was like to be a censor. And he titled it The Literary Torturer because that was his nickname. And his nickname was The Literary Torturer because he did that work of censoring newspaper articles or novels or whatever he was given. You know, he did that action of cutting words in the office that was formerly used to torture prisoners of war when the Japanese, during World War II, when the Japanese were occupying Rangoon. So they compared the act of censorship to the act of torture because, and what they said was that he was torturing ideas or he was torturing thoughts.
Right. And what was it like for your stories to be censored?
It was at times infuriating, at times just completely perplexing. Mm-hmm. And when I was working at the Myanmar Times, you know, there was something kind of nice about having a pre-censorship because you knew that it wasn't your job to censor yourself. Mm-hmm. So you could go ahead and write things and give it a go and see whether or not it would get through. Just give it a try. Uh-huh. And we had to remind ourselves also always to keep trying to push the boundaries and seeing like what we could get through. It was difficult though sometimes because obviously when you're in the act of writing a story, you have an instinct mm-hmm. of where you want to take the story, you know, what questions you want to ask, who you want to call. And you catch yourself thinking, oh no, I can't do that. It'll just get cut. But obviously, like, that's where the story is, exactly where you want to control the instinct. Yeah. That's where the story is. Right. So.
And now you're not censored, at least not totally. And you've been writing about some pretty serious topics. Let's talk about the story about the monk.
Yeah, so I did a TV interview with Uiratu, who is a very popular, well-known monk who has a lot of supporters and happens to make speeches that are very Islamophobic and mm-hmm. at times seem to be calling for violence against Muslims. And he denies that his speeches are inciting violence. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, he has been a supporter of the interfaith marriage ban and has said, I have him on the record saying things like, the reason there's violence in Burma is that there's too many Muslims. Mm-hmm. It would be better if there weren't any Muslims.
Right.
So he's quite a divisive figure. And I think for people in the West, it's very strange to hear that a Buddhist monk could be violent or give hate speech. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been a really shocking thing for a lot of people about this story, is that Buddhists are capable of fundamentalism, just like members of any other religion. And I think Wiratu manages to kind of get away with saying really horrible things in the name of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. Now, this monk somewhat reflects the population overall, which is predominantly Buddhist. Isn't that right?
That's true.
So, you know, I guess most prejudice is caused by ignorance, and if you have a kind of just a one type of religion, it's hard for people to understand other religions, and now that's helping to lead to this violence. So tell us about what's happening with the religious violence, the attacks on the Muslims.
Yeah, most recently there was another incident in Sitwe, which is in northern Rakhine State, which is the state that borders Bangladesh, which is where the ethnic Rohingya Muslims are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of been the epicenter, or not the epicenter, but it's where it started.
Mm-hmm.
But there's all kinds of Muslim groups all over the country. And the government, I think, underestimates the percentage of the population that is Muslim. And there's lots of Muslims all over the country that are victims of violence done by their Buddhist neighbors. Mektila, which is in central Myanmar near the capital, near Naypyidaw. I was there to do some reporting after violence broke out, and there was a massacre at a school where 44 people were murdered, or 44 Muslim boys were murdered by a crowd of Buddhists while the police looked on.
Oh.
And it's a really difficult conflict to understand, because there are these communities where there are people of different religious groups living side by side, and a very small incident can serve to ignite incredible violence. And these mobs of essentially farmers get together with their farming gear, and sometimes it's Buddhist monks joining in, and they feel that they need to protect themselves from the threat of Muslims, because they're afraid that the Muslims are taking their land, or they're afraid that they're using resources. They're afraid that the Muslims are, there's always this threat to the bloodline, that Muslims are marrying Buddhist women and turning them Muslim and then having more Muslim children. Which has been at the root of this proposed interfaith marriage ban. So it's a really difficult thing to witness. I've been living in Myanmar since 2009, and I have lots of Burmese friends that I consider to be very educated, liberal, open-minded, yet they still seem to think that saying Islamophobic things is okay. Even my really liberal-minded friends will say things like, oh, well, Muslims aren't really Burmese anyway, or they don't really belong. And go ahead.
And is this Muslim violence being reported in the domestic media?
It is being reported in the domestic media, and it's always a bit of a sticky subject.
Are the journalists there just so used to being censored that they unconsciously censor themselves? Do you get a feeling of that?
I think there is a lot of self-censorship that goes on, but it's becoming less and less. And I think in general, there was such a habit during the censorship days, and that you just didn't want to offend anyone. None of the censors were ideologues. Nobody really thought that censorship was necessary for, you know, controlling the thoughts of the people. It wasn't, you know, it's not communist China. It's just that nobody wanted to get in trouble, and nobody. So that mentality remains a lot. And there's a lot of, as a reporter, you face bureaucrats or, you know, there's people that you have to interview or talk to, and they just won't talk because they're afraid of getting in trouble. And then as a reporter, sometimes you take on some of that, you know, you don't even realize it, but someone's nervous about it. So you get nervous, and so then you don't want to report it because you're afraid of getting them in trouble.
Okay. And do you have friends who are journalists there for local outlets?
Yeah.
And what's it like for them? And I know that they just started allowing daily newspapers, and that's a challenge to put out a daily newspaper in that country, I imagine.
It is. There's a lot of new reporters. It's newspapers are hiring in Burma.
What are some of the problems that they're running into in practicing their profession?
A lot of them don't have the training that they want, because there just hasn't, you know, we need more training for journalists here. And then a lot of them still, you know, you get intimidated and you get bullied because there are some bureaucrats who just haven't gotten the memo yet that there's a free press. Mm-hmm. And in some ways there isn't a free press, because even though there's no censorship, obviously that's a great step forward, there's still a completely hobbled justice system. Mm-hmm. And if you write the wrong story, you could get sued and put in jail. You know, even if you haven't actually done anything wrong, just because someone has it in for you.
Well, I imagine that's difficult also in trying to cover some of the economic issues that are surfacing now, you know, with these huge investments from Western countries, and there's talk about untapped resources in the South. And are those the types of stories that you're talking about?
Yeah. So a really well-known and well-respected editor of a journal in Myanmar, his reporters uncovered a graft scandal in the Ministry of Industry that was, you know, a pretty big deal, got a lot of people in trouble, and they got sued for libel. But it was never clear who was actually suing the paper and what for, and it looked like the ministry was suing him, but that's not really allowed. And he was paralyzed. He couldn't put out his paper for a while. He couldn't work. They lost a lot of money. And he hadn't technically done anything wrong because he could prove, you know, they'd done a good investigation, but it was just someone didn't like it. So they were able to, through the hobbled justice system, really stick to him.
Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbi.org or our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. Speaking of social media, now there's not much internet penetration in Burma, and not much TV. Talk to us about the media consumption habits in Burma now.
One of the nice things about Burma is that people really love to read the news and talk about the news, and they will read it in newspapers because they don't read that much news on the internet except for on Facebook. They're all really into reading news on Facebook and sharing news on Facebook. Or those who have internet, I shouldn't say they all. People really do read newspapers, and that really distinguishes Burma from a lot of its neighbors. And then people listen to the radio a lot, and there's a lot of new radio stations that just came up or just got started in the past couple of years. And they're doing a lot of news, or a lot of them are broadcasting their own news programs, and people are listening to it.
Okay, and they're not much into TV.
It's more, I guess, especially if you go out in the countryside, people are more likely to listen to radio than read newspapers because the newspapers don't circulate that widely, and they're not likely to have televisions, so they're more likely to get their news on the radio.
And there is some censorship of television, and I know that you earlier mentioned before we went on the air about the this when you were watching Rambo on television in Burma.
Tell us they turned happened. It off and turned on Dr. Doolittle.
So the government didn't like the way Burma was being depicted and switched.
In Rambo. Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Seems like they just put Dr. Doolittle on any time they didn't like. I've seen Dr. Doolittle so many times.
That's the go-to show when they want to censor
the content.
Yeah, a couple
of years ago. Yeah.
Now you're in Berlin now, where you were raised, and you know, taking a break, and so when you talk to people about living in Burma, do you talk about the isolation you feel there?
Yeah, I guess I do. I do complain about that sometimes. I shouldn't, but there aren't that many foreigners living in Burma at the moment. Although there's a lot more than there used to be. And you often get feel quite out of place, mm-hmm. and are often the center of unwanted attention, which can be quite alienating. So mm-hmm. when I leave my apartment in the morning and go to the market to buy mangoes or something, my neighbors will all sort of inform each other of the fact that I've just bought mangoes, even though it's a completely mm-hmm. uninteresting detail about my life. I can hear them think, oh, the foreigner bought mangoes. Oh, yeah. So she did yesterday, too. Oh, she really likes those mangoes.
Okay. And so when you're out there, you are like one of, say, there's 100 people in a restaurant. How many yeah. foreigners will be there?
Well, I guess it depends what part of town, yeah. but I mean, in general, you know, you're probably the only foreigner in the restaurant, unless you're going to a restaurant where they serve pizza.
Okay. What are some of the Western businesses that have opened there now?
So for a little while, we all thought there was going to be a KFC, and we were completely horrified, but it turns out that it was a fake KFC, and they've uh-huh. been forced to take down their sign.
Okay.
But there's a Korean chicken, barbecue chicken chain that's opening soon called BBQ, and some Singaporean food chains have come in, and some Thai, like CP is a Thai brand that's now, you can okay. now buy in Burma.
Okay. Well, let's conclude with the serious question about where you think Burma is headed. It's an emerging democracy. Nobody but people over the age of 60 or so knew what life was like before the military dictatorship until the past couple of years. How do you think things are going to go in the coming years as far as freedoms, lifestyle, the economy?
Nothing moves too quickly in Burma, it seems, with a lot of these reforms. So I think we'll just see this bit by bit pace. Mm-hmm. Although I guess in some ways it has come very far, very quickly, but it's really difficult to say even what will mark the success of the reforms. We're seeing some economic indicators improve for some people, but we're not really sure how those are going to shake out. And then a lot of people seem to think that whether or not Aung San Suu Kyi becomes president is a measure of reform. Mm-hmm. But we're not, how can we even really be sure that she's going to be a good president? And then there's the question of the great fight over Burma's natural resources and how that's going to shake out. Mm-hmm. And then this ethnic violence issue, I don't see it going away anytime soon. And all of the ceasefire agreements with the rebel groups
right.
on borders, I don't see that really getting much better in the next 5 years. I think in 5 years we'll see Burma probably still trying to get ceasefire agreements, probably still dealing with an ethnic violence or a religious mm-hmm. violence issue. And perhaps Dasu will be president, perhaps not, and maybe it won't really make a difference.
Okay.
When
you're going to be going back, when are you going to be back in the country?
In a week.
Why do you keep going back?
Good question.
Have you fallen in love with the country now? Do you just like working there?
I like working there. I guess the reason I keep going back is that there's such wonderful people there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really curious myself to see how it goes. I mean, I've been reporting the story for this long, and it's just now starting to get really interesting, and it's just now starting to...
Okay.
I guess the more people you know, the better you know the story, the more you understand it, the more thrilling it is to see it unfold.
Okay. Well, thanks for giving us this insight into this mysterious country. Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today was Gabrielle Paluk, a freelance journalist who covered Burma before and after the reform movement. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Nin Pham and Mikkel Christensen were the lead producers. Stay with us for Free Press Watch, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, Global Journalist's weekly rundown of the major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Tyler McConnell. Today's news comes from Libya and Guatemala. A well-known Libyan television journalist was killed last Friday in the eastern city of Benghazi, according to local media. Ezzedine Kassad was shot dead by three unidentified gunmen while sitting in his car near a blood bank. News reports indicate that Kassad had received threatening phone calls days before his murder, demanding that he not deliver an on-air speech celebrating the Muslim festival of Eid al-Fitr, which marks the end of Ramadan. The journalist was killed the day after his speech aired. Kassad, a medical doctor by training and respected community leader, had been working as a reporter for Benghazi's Al-Hurra television station since the 2011 uprising that ousted former dictator Muammar Gaddafi from power. Guatemala has become one of the most dangerous places in Central America for journalists, following the murder of a Guatemalan radio reporter last week. Jesus Lima, a 68-year-old veteran broadcast journalist, was pronounced dead at the scene after unknown assailants shot him twice in Zacapa City, according to international reports. Lima was shot while exiting his car just outside of the Sultana radio station, where he hosted a weekly music and information program. Lima is the third journalist killed in Guatemala since the beginning of this year. The other killings have occurred under similar circumstances. For more information on these and other stories involving press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Tyler McConnell.